Well, this morning we're finally coming to the end of this series on perseverance, and I've chosen to return to this particular passage once again for several reasons. Firstly, I think that just the issue of the loyalty and the courage that these first century Christians displayed really deserves a second, if not a third, investigation into their lives. I think we owe them that to some degree. And what we have discovered so far about these ancient people in Smyrna is that loyalty played an important key role in how they lived their lives. And this was true of both of the unbelievers who lived there as well. Because remember, the Roman and the Greek people who made up that city were fiercely loyal to Rome. Smyrna was the center of the emperor worship cult in the empire. And once these people gave their allegiance to someone, they were faithful to a fault, which is why Cicero, one of Rome's most famous politicians, said of Smyrna, that she was one of our most faithful and most ancient allies, long before Rome was the undisputed mistress of the world, says William Barclay. Smyrna cast in her lot with her, never to waver in its fidelity. So loyalty was a big deal in the city of Smyrna. And the same seems to be true of the Christians that lived there. Once they had given their hearts to Jesus, nothing seemingly could persuade them to be disloyal to him. Not the prospect of poverty, not beatings, not even the prospect of death. Which is why Jesus had so many good things to say to this church. Many of us have perhaps heard of the courage of Polycarp, a famous Christian martyr who was burned at the stake for his faith. His trial and martyrdom have become legendary throughout church history. But perhaps you didn't know is that Polycarp was martyred there in Smyrna. Smyrna is where he died. Because he grew up, Polycarp was both born and raised in Smyrna. And he was the pastor of the church there. And even when he was given several chances by the Roman magistrate to save his life, if all he had to do was just to deny Christ and burn incense to the emperor, but Polycarp continued to refuse. And finally he told the Roman prefect, "What are you waiting for? Bring forth what you will. I'm not going to deny him. So just get on with it." In other words, whatever you're going to do, let's go and let's quit talking about it. You know, when you look at that, you can't help but stand back and be impressed by such extraordinary valor in the face of such overwhelming opposition. And I can't help but wonder, does our faith contain that same kind of courage? Sadly, when I look at the state of American Christianity today, I got to say I'm not seeing a whole lot of that kind of loyalty from American Christians. When I look at the courage and faith of these first century Christians in Smyrna, what they had, I think we need some of that. We need what they got, what they had. Because I think our freedom, and though we joy our freedom as Americans, I think we have become far too soft and comfortable for our own good. It seems that for many of us, the moment life gets hard, the moment we're asked to sacrifice or to put our love for Jesus ahead of ourselves, we're out, you know? I quit, that's it, I'm done. And we fade back into our comfort zone because we never learn that there exists something more important than my own life in this world. We've never learned the value of loyalty. We've only ever run from suffering instead of allowing it to do its persevering work in our life. We're always praying, God, take it away, take it away, take it away. And in the end, we're entirely unprepared for persecution when it comes. And it will come in some way, shape, or form. If you love God and are committed to being a disciple of Jesus in a world that hates it, it's going to come. And so what we've been asking of this text in front of us this morning is, how does a persecuted Christian persevere to the end without giving up or giving in? Well, we've been seeking to identify seven things in this passage that you need to remember amidst persecution when the gathering storm finally arrives at your doorstep. And the first thing that we found from verse 8 is that you need to remember who Jesus is. He introduces himself as the one who's, these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came back to life. We also need to remember from verse 9 that when you suffer, that Jesus suffers with you. Jesus says, I know your afflictions and your poverty. We ought never to think that Jesus has somehow lost track of where we are, that somehow the details and the surroundings of our situations have somehow escaped his notice. No, he knows about it. And that should encourage us to hang on and not give up. So that's the second thing. But here's the third. You need to remember that losing is really winning. Notice what he says. I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. Now, the poverty that these folks have been experiencing was truly oppressive, because the Greek word for poverty that Jesus uses to describe their situation is more than just the run-of-the-mill, I don't make as much money as somebody else does kind of poverty. This is abject poverty. That's what that word means. The idea is being destitute, homeless even. Now, you might think that you're poor in comparison to others in this country, but here's what I've discovered to be true. If you really want to know, if you really want to learn what abject poverty really is, you just have to travel to a third world country. We are rich in comparison, fabulously rich in comparison to other countries. Now, the Christians here in Smyrna, though they weren't poor because they were lazy. They weren't poor because they were uneducated or because they simply lived in a poor country. In fact, the city of Smyrna was quite wealthy, in fact. But notice that Jesus links their poverty with their afflictions. In other words, their poverty is due to the fact that they were believers who were loyal to Jesus. They weren't going to follow the crowd. They weren't going to worship the emperor. They weren't going to worship false gods. And because of that, they were experiencing poverty. What seems likely here is this is a government-imposed poverty. Perhaps they had been subjected to mobs of angry people looting what they had. Perhaps they were thrown out of their homes. Perhaps they had their goods or businesses confiscated. And all because they loved Jesus. It was probably the government's way of forcing compliance to the laws of emperor worship. Because see, the Romans knew that a man will do almost anything to protect his livelihood, to ensure that he doesn't go hungry, that his kids don't go hungry. Because they knew that facing the prospect of losing all that you hold dear might tempt you, any ordinary man, to abandon his faith and deny Christ. But these believers, they refused to submit, even if it meant losing everything they had, even if it meant poverty. Now understand, losing everything is a very real prospect in Christian discipleship. This is nothing new. Remember Jesus said, "For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for me will save it." In other words, if you seriously want to follow Jesus, prepare to lose some things. When I was in Nepal, I learned that the people of Nepal truly knew this truth. They knew accepting Jesus may cost them. In fact, I had a number of people that would, you know, the reason they rejected Christ was ultimately because of this. They saw the cost and they knew that. I had this one lady who said to me, you know, her husband, a lot of the men go and work in other countries because in Nepal it's just so poor. And her husband was away, and we had witnessed to her about Jesus, and she said, I really want to do this, but I'm going to have to ask my husband first. That was the first time I was really tempted to lie and say, oh yeah, I talked to your husband, he said it's fine, just go ahead and trust the Lord as your Savior. But I didn't do that, but that was really the issue. And I think what she was really saying was the fact that I know what this will cost me. If I accept Jesus as my Savior, my husband might divorce me. I might lose everything that I have. Whosoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. I think that's such an amazing truth. It's the grand paradox of life. Hold on to your life and you'll end up wasting it. Spend your life and you'll get more of it. That's the idea. That is, if you really want to know what it's like to live, says Jesus, let go of your life, risk it all, be willing to lose it all. And here's what you're going to find. You're going to find it all. To have nothing and yet everything. Jesus taught us from the very get-go that there's a cost in following him. And there's a cost because the world hates us. And the world hates us because it hated him. It's just the way things are. But the question that we draw from this is, you know, here's what we see these Christians who are in Smyrna who are losing things, who are becoming poor by the day, seemingly, because they won't submit to worshiping other gods because of their loyalty. And that really begs the question that I ask of myself, and I ask it of you as well, is that what are you willing to lose simply because you love and follow Jesus? See, here's the good news that Jesus gives to this church in Smyrna. He says, notice, he says, you might be poor in this world's things, but your poverty, because of Jesus, has made you rich in the sight of God. See, rich and poor, whether you're rich or poor, is really in the eye of the beholder to some extent. What is poor in Nepal is not poor in the U.S. I mean, I learned that the average Nepali makes 300 rupees a day. Sounds like a lot, but it's really only $3 a day. And when I told them that somebody at Taco Casa can, you know, earn like $9 a day, which is, I don't know what the minimum wage is. Was it 10? Is it close to 9 or 10? I don't know what it is. Is it 7? Okay. Well, either way, it blew them away. Are you serious? $9 an hour? They just couldn't believe it. He said, you guys are so rich. Yeah, the Nepalis, they don't have wealth like us. But the Nepali Christians, they don't have wealth like us, and yet they are far richer than we are in many ways. Many are abandoned by their families when they accept Jesus. And yet you should hear them pray. You should hear them worship. It's stunning. From a worldly perspective, these Smyrnan Christians were losers. They chose a life of poverty and persecution in favor of Jesus. The world might call them losers, idiots for doing that, but from God's perspective, they're rich in reward because of whatever they have lost in Christ will be gained fourfold in eternity. So understand this principle. Winning and losing is, they are not what you think they are. It may seem at times as a faithful Christian that you're always seemingly coming in last place. But I want you to understand something. If it seems that way, that's not really what's going on. I know you're poverty, but you're rich. Sometimes losing is really winning. And winning is really losing. And knowing that, understanding that, and accepting that as truth is going to help you persevere in hard times. That's number three. Number four, the fourth thing you need to remember in order to persevere as a persecuted Christian, you need to remember who the real enemy is behind your suffering. Jesus says, I know the slander of those, in verse 9, who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Now, the Christians in Smyrna were really in a tough spot because apparently in Smyrna, along with the Romans and Greeks who lived there, there was also a large Jewish population. And the Jews were no friends of the church. And apparently they were slandering the Christians to the Roman overlords. They were acting, in a sense, as informers for the Roman government against the Christians. And so the church was really in between a rock and a hard place, slandered by the Jews on one hand and oppressed by the Roman state on the other. The church just couldn't win. Everywhere they went, they were surrounded by enemies, hated by the Jews for believing in someone they considered a false Messiah, and hated by the Romans because they refused to worship their pagan gods. The Romans believed that this was the refusal by the church would anger the Roman gods and thus bring about the end of their city's wealth and prosperity. If you continue to worship this Jesus, that's going to affect the bottom line. The money in my pocket. The status of our city in the Roman world. That's why they were hated. That's why Christians were hated. I mean, can you imagine any more of an oppressive and fearful atmosphere to live under? That's why it's important to understand who your enemy is in a situation like that. Whenever you're in a battle to survive, you have to be able to know, it's helpful to know, who your enemy is. And here Jesus identifies the enemies of the church as those who say they are Jews but are not. In other words, these people believe themselves to be Jews, that is, God's chosen people, but they're really not. They're really a synagogue of Satan, he calls them. By slandering the church, they were really serving Satan's purposes, not God. Ever been slandered before? Ever have people say things about you that's not really true? How do you fight that? In fact, that's one of the things we're always worried about. Wonder what people are thinking about me, right? Well, the church had difficulty with that back then, too. There's all kinds of ancient slander that went on behind the scenes. The Romans felt that The church was a danger because they thought that they were incestuous. And why did they think that they were actually practicing incest, that the church was doing that? Because these Christians all call each other brother and sister. So there must be incest going on. The pagans also believed that the church was, the people, the Christians, were also cannibals. They accused them of being cannibals. Cannibals? Why did they believe that? Well, because of the Lord's Supper. They kept talking about the body and the blood of Christ. So all of that kind of thing was going on, and how do they fight in that? You know, I was just thinking about this. The most frequent asked question that we ask in hard times, and it may have been a question that on the minds of these believers, it may be a question that has come up in your mind from time to time when your life has hit the hard times, when you suffer. And that question is, why is this happening to us? Ever ask that question when you're experiencing trials and tribulations? Well, Jesus has alluded to the Romans, and now he mentions the Jews, but who's really behind all of this? It's Satan. They're a synagogue of Satan. Have you ever wondered why Christianity has been and continues to be one of the most persecuted religions in the world? How come you don't see Hindus and Buddhists being beheaded in ISIS videos? Why is the liberal left and the media so pro-Muslim and so anti-Christian in this country? Why are some people so offended by a monument in a courthouse that has, the Ten Commandments engraved on it, but they have no problem with transgender bathrooms? Why do people, unbelievers swear? And when they swear, all kinds of filth comes out of their mouths, right? Why is it the name of Jesus Christ and not Muhammad that they slander? Something happens, and they use that word. Jesus Christ. Why, after 2,000 years, does there continue to be this well-funded, organized, systematic persecution of the church? Jesus tells us why. It is Satan who is slandering the church. By the way, Satan, the name Satan means adversary. The word devil means accuser, and that's what he is. He is your adversary and your accuser. It's Satan that is promoting the slander of the church in verse 9, and it's Satan in verse 10, you notice, who's going to throw some of these believers into prison, and it's Satan, notice, who's going to have some of them killed. It's Satan. Satan has been behind this whole thing the whole time. Persecution of the church exists and has existed from the beginning because Satan hates Jesus, and because he hates Jesus, he hates you. And so what we need to take away from this is that we must understand that when we hit hard times, we must understand that when we choose to follow Jesus, that we have joined an already ongoing spiritual war between good and evil, between God and Satan. Verse 10 says, the devil is going to put some of you in prison, he says, to test you. You see, if he can, Satan will seek to do in your life what he sought to do in the lives of these Smyrna Christians. He'll bring hard times to test you. He'll use suffering to try and shake your faith in God. He'll try to winnow your faith. You know what winnowing is? Every harvest time, you watch the combines out here. They're harvesting the wheat. And you'll notice all that stuff comes out the back. And this giant dust cloud follows the combine. What is all that? That's the chaff. That's the stuff that gets left over once the machine has done its job of separating the wheat from the chaff, the grain, from those little bits and pieces of it that you don't need. And in many ways, this is what we see that suffering does. Although God brings tests, but notice in the passage, so does Satan. And yet God and Satan have different goals for suffering in relation to the Christian. Satan uses suffering for evil. He is seeking to winnow the grain of faith from your life, to leave only the chaff of hopelessness and defeat. We've seen some people, have we not? We've known some people whose life has kind of messed up their faith, and they're kind of hopeless, living in defeat. That's what Satan is trying to do. He's trying to get you to quit following Jesus. And he'll use suffering to do it. But God, on the other hand, uses suffering for good. Whereas Satan tries to winnow the grain, to get rid of the grain of your faith and only leave you with chaff, God winnows the chaff. He uses suffering to get rid of the chaff, not the wheat. The chaff of sinfulness and doubt or anything that doesn't look like Jesus, in order to leave the grain of faith that perseveres, so that there is nothing left but hope and joy in a faith that does not fade. What Satan means for evil, God means for good. And beloved, once we know that, once we rest in that and accept that, that knowledge will help us persevere. See, beloved, whether we like it or not, the truth is we need suffering. Our faith needs to be tested, because in some weird way, suffering and trials produce endurance. Now, we may not like that, but that's just the way it works. Without them, we don't persevere. Without them, we don't grow. And God knows this. And in his great love for us, he allows Satan to test us by bringing suffering, just like he did in the life of Job, just like he did in the lives of these Smyrna Christians. I remember when I was in Pillsbury, I took this conditioning class, and basically all it is they run you until you drop, and then they make you, you know, lift weights until your arms are jelly, right? And I remember at the beginning of the class, we had to go up the pegboard, this thing, you know, you put these pegs as you go up and come all the way down. The first time I tried it, I don't think I even got halfway, and I dropped to the ground. But after the conditioning class, it was amazing. I went all the way up and came halfway back down by the time I dropped. And I looked at that and I said, man, I've made progress. I may have hated every single minute of this class, having to run all the time and all doing all the weightlifting, but I guarantee, but obviously what is true is that it has conditioned me to be able to do that pegboard. And that's true of suffering too. When we allow suffering and perseverance to do their work, we'll come out the other end stronger, happier than we've ever been, in a deeper relationship and a deeper love for God than we ever had before. And it'll be at that point that we'll actually look back upon our sufferings with fondness, the way Paul did. They'll become something of an ugly little treasure to us. Not because of the pain, but because of what they produced in us. Well, all of that then leads us to something even more important that we need to remember. And that is that you need to remember that you you don't need to be afraid of suffering because God is still in control. Notice what he says there in verse 10. He says, Satan, yes, he says, do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Don't be afraid of what you're about to suffer, he says. Now, it's at this point